the equities, which sectors had you been covering?
We covered breweries, stores, aircrafts, motors, engineering, a sort of general leader book, like ICI and Courtauld and Unilever, a few shipping companies, and then when the local man closed down in insurance shares, we took those on, and of course we had the big, the gilt edge side. I know that I missed out a couple of sectors. I can't remember what they were.
Were there stocks for which there was purely a local market in which you
joined? There was a smattering of local stocks. Threlfall's Brewery, Higson's Brewery, Greenall's, yes. But no, it was also, it also included all the national names as well. I mean, in the stores line, yes, we'd do Owen & Owen, which is a local store, but we also did Marks & Spencer's and Tesco, Woolworths. So it was basically the well-known national companies and a smattering of local stocks.
Did you then move on to the gilt book?
I did, yes. They wanted me to go onto the broking side, but I said no. And at that stage, when you'd been dealing in, jobbing in equities, and you answered the phone, and these were days before when you just a phone, there was no key and lamp, or any of the new modern things here. You'd pick up the phone, and it would be a gilt edge call, and you'd say, oh, God. And you'd almost throw it down to the other person, yeah, it's yours. Right? And you didn't want to know about gilts. You always thought, that, as an equity dealer, I always thought the gilts were deadly dull and boring. Well, cutting a long story short, I soon found there was quite a bit to them, and spent many happy years jobbing in gilts.
And how long did that continue for?
Gilts?
Yes.
Well, it's still going, even in where we are now, because what happened was that we split the firm in 1974. Dual capacity officially came to an end in 1972, but the stock exchange allowed you to carry on for a period of up to 2 years if there was hardship. By hardship, I mean, because of partnership taxation was a bit complicated and it took a little bit to alter the partnership structure. And we actually split the firm in 1974. And then we carried on in Liverpool, and in fact still have an office in Liverpool, but we joined Phillips and Drew in 1985, I think it was, and then became UBS Phillips and Drew last year, 18 months ago. And a lot of my ex-partners are still, well, we didn't, there were only seven of us, but we're all still, or until a couple of weeks ago, we were all still employed working, or we all still worked in UBS Phillips and Drew. Why say until a couple of weeks ago? One had to retire through ill health, and one retired at the statutory retirement age of 60. So the firm is, underneath is still there.
The creation of the stock exchange in the mid-70s made any difference to the actual structure of the regional business? I mean, did you still, in effect, operate as the Northern Stock Exchange?
Yes, still, but it was much easier to deal with any jobber at all then, because you could just ring up and deal wherever it was. So that added to the competition, which was no bad thing. So that was the main difference that we noticed. The ease of dealing anywhere at all in the country, in its wide sense, i.e. including London.
Yeah. Prior to the 70s, for example, when you did start a separate jobbing part of the firm, did you as partners try to steer the firm in any particular direction? Did you want to expand the business? Did you want to try and increase your market share? Or were you quite happy with the living that you as partners were making from it, and were quite happy to exist?
No, I think that one always wants to try and expand the firm a little bit, if not a lot. And certainly we were trying to expand to get ready for the split, which we knew was coming. And the broking, you see, Henry Rensburg was originally a shunting firm. And it was only after the war when, of course, I wasn't taking any interest in it at that stage, but when the then senior partner got some other of his friends in, or other, not friends, other people he'd met on the market just before the war, he'd started to get a few people in, and then more, and they built up, after the war, the broking business, because there wasn't any broking business in that firm before the war, or very little. It was primarily a shunter. So they had a big expansion in the broking business, and that was continuing throughout the time I was there and until we split. We split because of the rules of the stock exchange. We didn't split because the partnership fell out. Mm. A lot of people think it was that. It wasn't. People who weren't in the business thought, oh, they must have had a bust-up. It wasn't that at all. It was purely that the rules of the market changed. So, yes, we were... The partners were trying to expand the business, A, in the broking side, that had been going on for a number of years, and of course when we go into jobbing in equities, we try to expand that. Mm. And in doing so, of course, it helped with the gilt side. And we always were looking, I mean, we were, I think, yes, we were without doubt one of the biggest jobbers at that stage in the country. Mm. And certainly when we packed up and just kept on in gilts, we were by far the largest gilt-edged firm. In fact, there are only three, latterly only two in the country. Compared to London firms, we were the minnow in volume in the size of the bargains going through. But we were pretty high up the list on the number of deals. In other words, we did a lot of small deals with low value, whereas the Weds and Aykroyds in London were doing not so many deals, but with a very large value.
Did you have the same kind of merger activity taking place among local stock exchange firms that had been taking place in London, particularly during the 1970s?
Yes, because the number of firms dwindled quite a bit, and it was not uncommon for three firms to get together into one. I mean, normally you just get two getting together, but it happened quite a bit. And then the bigger ones would then join up again. So yes, you ended up with some very large partnerships in the provincial centres or the country centres, which were an amalgamation of over 10 years, 6-8 firms. Certainly, yes, that has happened a lot.
One of the arguments for single capacity was that in dual capacity one potentially had a conflict of interest.
Yes.
Was that, what were your feelings about that, having been in a dual capacity firm?
Yeah. My feelings were completely different to some of my more elderly partners at that stage, because you know, they didn't like the idea of splitting the firm because they'd been partners together for a long time, which I understood. But I wasn't so much worried about that, because I was definitely of the view that you had to be very careful if you were dealing with one of your own clients in the firm and off your own book. It could lead to... you could easily get into trouble, I felt. And we adopted a policy of not giving the broking side any favour in nations terms. And they actually did, in the end, do an awful lot. Well, not in the end. They did a lot of deals with other people rather than with us. And we were quite happy, in a way, because it showed that we were being... well, nowadays, you've got Chinese walls. I mean, it was a forerunner of that, I suppose. we really only dealt with the other, with the broking side, if we were convinced that the price was the same around the country. We didn't like to put anything in cheaper, because you could be accused of, and equally you could some. There's always the risk of trying to rip the other side off as well, and the easiest thing was not to do it. That made life much easier. In gilts, we did a completely different thing, though. In gilts, if we dealt, because there was only really one other fellow, what we did, in fact, the rules changed, and this is why we did it. They did bring in a rule about dealing off your own book. And what we used to do was, in a gilt edge stock, because we had the volume of business going through, which I probably didn't want to deal with our client side like that, we would actually sell the stock to him, and he'd then sell it back to our client side and give him a turn in the middle to get the business done. But again, at the right price in the market. But it was very complicated, and the sooner we split off, the better.
I wonder if I could ask you to go through what a typical day may have been for you. Well, just to arbitrarily pick a date, sometime in the early 70s.
This is going to be testing, isn't it? Well, we started later. The gilt market, I can't remember. The gilt market started, I think, about 10 o'clock. Mm. And then it came to 9:15 or 9:30, I forget. So you get in roughly 9:15. Half hour's train journey. And we'd have a chat. See what we read in the papers. And we'd have the chat in the dealing room or sometimes in the partner's private office. And then we'd get our prices. We always had an idea of what they were in. The gilt market's quite easy because basically it used to, they all went up or they all went down. Pro rata, it moved, all the stocks moved together. It's a very simplistic way of explaining it, but still. and the phones would start ringing, and you were off. And, I mean, sometimes it didn't ring. That was always terrible. We'd have, years before, we used to go out for coffee at 11 o'clock or whenever it was to the local coffee shops, and we'd take it in turns to go out. But at this juncture, when we'd split the phone, 1974, we actually stayed at our desk and had coffee there. And then we'd stagger a lunch hour. But we'd normally eat lunch in the office. Once or twice a week we might go out. When I say eat lunch in the office, not at our dealing desk. There was an unwritten rule in the firm that you were not allowed to eat at the desk at which you worked. You had to move to another desk, just to give you a different change of scenery. I mean, just to relieve the boredom. And we stuck rigidly to that. So you might go through to your partner, because we always had a partner's office where there were three or four of us would share one big office. In fact, sometimes it's a waste of time, because if you're a jobbing firm, your partners are active dealers, so you're either on the pitch or in your dealing room, and you're not sitting behind a partner's desk. But so it was the most underused area in the office. And then you'd go through, and market would close 3:30, I think it was. Bit of admin work, and those were the days. 5 o'clock, train home, easy, wasn't it?
So you weren't actually physically going onto a floor; you were dealing over the phones, more or less as a dealer would deal today, over a phone.
Yeah, we were one of the first to pull off the floor in Liverpool, and then we went back because they said, "Well, you know, would you like to go back?" They didn't actually put pressure on us to go back, so we did. We went back, and in fact, got a little room off the floor, so that we were still very much in touch with our man on the floor. But then the floor started to die as other brokers started moving. And in fact, in Liverpool, we ended up, the floor became my office. And we became our dealing room and office. So in the end, we stayed there to the very end.
Was that characteristic of most firms that were doing country jobbing in the sense that they were primarily dealing on floors? Or they were not?
No, they were primarily dealing on the floors, most of the others, yes, indeed. But I think their market floors were a bit more... Liverpool had its contraction in the number of firms very early. And therefore, the floor packed up earlier than the others did. And this was just one of those quirks of fate. The other thing about the day, though, was that by the time I went home at night, or late afternoon, probably, we knew our profit and loss for the day. And that we always prided ourselves in that. So we always knew, even when we're dealing in equities, we always knew the P&L before we went home. We put a computer in, and we hadn't got a cat in hell's chance. We then only knew it the next morning. So until then, but then we put another one in, and that gave it us back. We went back to normal then. But it was very important. At least we always used to think it was, to know that. You've then felt you were in command of the business.
During the course of the day, were you able to have some idea what your opposition was quoting in the same stocks? Or did you feel that you were quite...
You wouldn't
cut
know
off?
Exactly what they were quoting, but you've got a fair idea. You knew what the middle price was, roughly. Yes.
And did you actually, each as individual partners, have a separate book of stocks that you alone, or would you have an understudy? Or
no, we had separate books. In equities, I might have been running the Brodie book. I used to run Brodie and Stores. In gilts, yes, we split that up. You would either run the shorts, the mediums, the longs. So it was easy to do because the way the gilt market has grown, it was very easy to split it up. At that stage, into shorts, which were up to 5 years, mediums up 5 to 15, and longs. Irredeemables, there weren't enough, so you normally lump those in with the longs. There weren't enough of them to make it a separate book. And we lumped them in with the longs. So yes, we did have a separate book. And we'd occasionally change over. But when I say occasionally, I mean, we're talking about occasionally would be you'd stuck on a book for a year or two. And of course, if your colleague went away, then you'd try and look after his book.
Let me ask you some more general questions. Well, you've already touched on the links that the firm would have in London, and as I understand it, you essentially had an agent who would before the creation of a single stock exchange. Did you have links with the other provincial exchanges?
No. No, we didn't. Not in that way. Brokers in the other exchanges would ring us up and deal with us. Yes, because we were a jobber, and that was the way of fight. They'd ring up and ask a quote, and if you were right, if you gave them the right quote, they'd deal with you. They'd go round and try the market. They'd try London. They'd try Glasgow. They'd try Liverpool. Certainly, yeah. But we didn't have any links like an agent. At one stage, we considered putting a dealer on the floor in Birmingham, and in the end, we actually put a direct telephone line there. So there were no agents. In fact, we still used an agent in London to do a deal for us in gilts and keep us in touch with what was going on, and be our link with the government broker. To, I would guess, the early 80s, about 1881, when in fact this firm, Moy Vanderbilt, who are agents, they packed up, and I was actually on my way to London when that news broke, and I stayed here the week and went to see all the jobbers down here and arranged for the fellow who had been looking after us with Moy Vanderbilt to join my firm the next week, and then he became a partner with me. So in fact, I had a partner and a dealer based in London. but we guaranteed that we would not make prices on the London floor. These two would not make prices to any London broker. Mm. If the London brokers wanted a price, they had to ring us in Liverpool. Mm. And that system worked very well for a number of years. Mm.
But they were members and were permitted to go onto the floor of the house. And then
one was a member and one was an authorised dealer.
You mentioned the government broker.
Yes.
What form did your relations with the government broker take?
Well, if he was changing a tap price or making a new issue, he would go onto the floor and walk around the jobbers. And that news gets out pretty quickly, as you can imagine. And the jobbers were entitled to deal with him when he was changing his price. Now, we were 200 odd miles away, and he wasn't going to walk. By the time he'd walk around the floor and he rang us, you know, it could be half an hour or more. And my partner there, or dealer there, he'd just go to them and say, "Will you tell them in the north that the tap price has changed?" So, in a way, they were just as if we were standing on the floor. So that was our contact. And if we ever wanted to do anything with the government broker, we could ring him up. But more often than not, he would be on the floor. So Barry, who was my partner, could go up to him and say, "What a so-and-so. I'd like to put this proposition to you." So that was the relationship we had. I mean, yes, we would talk to him at various times of the day on the phone, but the main contact with him, and at his request, was in fact with our partner and dealer on the floor in London.
In more general terms, did you feel you were as adequately informed about a stock as the London jobbers were? Or did you ever feel that you were at a slight disadvantage being away from the main central market?
No, I don't think we were at a disadvantage. I think that it worked very well. It's a question of getting used to the system, and we just grew into it. There was no difficulty in the gilt market. There was no trouble whatsoever.
What was the advantage to a broker or a client to do business with you in Liverpool rather than go down to a more liquid market in London?
It was still liquid. The prices were hopefully the same, and if the price was the same or better, they would. Nowadays, it would be called best execution, I suppose. But they would deal where the price was best, and it was competition. And of course, we built up a bit of a reputation, and we used to go around and visit all the brokers in the various country centres. I think we used to try to get round to see them all every 2 years. We saw everybody over the course of every couple of years. And it was so that you quite a rapport grew up, quite a friendship developed. And this was how you got the business. And also, when you're dealing in small amounts of stock, they didn't just want to go and send someone into London to do it. So, and we were specialists in dealing with the small client. Mm. Sorry, the small client through his broker. Yes. And we did a tremendous number of the number of deals a day. The average size would be, I mean, I forget, I used to have the figures. Certainly at one stage it would be about £1,500 of stock nominal. It grew. It did grow quite dramatically, in fact. But we still do a lot of the small bargains here in this firm now. Although we have a very large gilt business, and hopefully we're dealing with major institutions, and so we're doing a large size, there's still the members of the public that have got small holdings in gilt-edged. And we still provide a service for that, in that we have a small desk on the dealing floor downstairs, which is manned by three or four people, and they concentrate on dealing with the brokers, either in London or in the country, who ring up. And we still have a staff up in Liverpool where the country brokers can ring as well, and that is, again, dealing with the brokers, the small brokers. Well, not some of them aren't so small, and indeed some of the orders they now get are much larger than they used to be. But we still support the small market.
Did you begin to see some of the larger institutional business
in Liverpool?
Yes.
Yes, I suppose we did, because the brokers did, as they were breaking into that business, they would give us sight of it, certainly. Our main expansion came one day, and it was very quiet, and I've forgotten the year, and a broker in London rang up and said, "We've just been flicking through our STX book, which is the internal telephone exchange in the stock exchange, and we see that it says here that you deal in gilts." Well, we knew the firm, and they were indeed quite a big player in the gilt market. And so we said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, what are you doing? What's the price of so and so and so and so?" And it was the first £1 million order that we did. In fact, it was £1 million both ways. And from that day on, until they merged, and I think ultimately a lot of their fellows left the new conglomerate they joined. But for that day on, for years and years, we spoke to them every day. And the main benefit we got was not so much, I mean, yes, when they came on with that first quote, there was no way I wasn't going to do the deal. But the main benefit was that we were talking to somebody who knew about the gilt edge market. And we could talk to them every day. We didn't necessarily deal with them every day, far from it, but we were suddenly speaking to somebody who knew a lot about the gilt market, whereas the majority of brokers, I think it's fair to say, and they wouldn't argue with me, didn't at that stage know an awful lot about the gilt market. But that was that helped us a lot. Mm. And from that, we started to deal with other London firms, and the business grew and grew.
Did you feel you were competing directly with the London jobbers, the Aykroyds or the Wedds, or?
We weren't competing with the Wets and Aykroyds, no. Mm. Yeah, now, yes. Mm. No, at that stage, no.
Did you feel you were able to be competitive, though, to some of the London
voltage jobbing? Oh, yes, certainly. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we had the disadvantage that we had to settle overnight. In other words, we had to send stock out 200 miles away. You can't deliver that during the day. Or you can't deliver the next day. So we had to have a very efficient and snappy back office. Because a night's interest is a lot. So we had to do that. So it had to be a pretty efficient organization, because we had to lose that. There was no way of doing anything else.
Now, one of the things that the London jobbers were criticised for coming up towards the end of single capacity was spread agreements, both in gilts and
price
in
agreements.
Equities.
Yes.
Yes. Was this something that Rensburg was involved in the sense that?
We changed the name to Molesdale.
When did that actually happen?
Well, we called ourselves, when we left Rensburg, when we split from Rensburg in 1974, we called ourselves Molesdale Rensburg. We realized that was a mistake fairly quickly, because it was confusing with Rensburg still going. So we dropped the Rensburg in a couple of years and just called ourselves Molesdale. That name came because when we split, he was the senior partner of the firm. And we were Molesdale until we joined. In fact, when we joined Phillips and Drew, we were Phillips and Drew Molesdale. And it's only in the last 18 months that the name has disappeared.
Yes, so were price agreements things that one participated in?
We didn't. We were never asked to, and we never did. There were certain stocks which you didn't make a normal price in, because they were bloody difficult to deal in, and so you might just be bid or offered. Certain stocks like Victory Falls and odd stocks that were difficult. And you would sometimes, if you were making a two-way price, it would be a point or 2 points. But that was market conditions more than a price agreement. We didn't, I'm not conscious of ever having agreed any price spreads. One thing I mean, we ourselves used to try and make, our basic idea was to try and make a price of a certain width, and then you could always close it. But we hadn't agreed to make it that width with other jobbers. No, but we tried to keep uniformity within our own firm.
One thing I believe the London jobbers occasionally criticised the provincial jobbers for was basically taking London's price and then seeking to undercut it.
I suppose a fair amount of that did go on, yes, particularly after then the when it started up, to try and get the business. I think that did go on. In Gilt's, no, it didn't really pay to try and do that. I mean, you're in a cash business. We had to worry about being out of